Welcome to the Saturday Frights Podcast. I am your co-host, the Projectionist, and I bid you welcome to the Haunted Drive-In. Come, join us down in the vault with your host, Vic Sage, as we discuss the best in pop culture and retro-related horror films and television shows.
Exploding in unspeakable horror, the Green Slime.
Projectionist, do you like 1968's The Green Slime?
It is not what I would call my favorite science fiction horror film, Sage, but it's entertaining nonetheless. It would appear the patrons of the Haunted Drive-In enjoy it enough to have requested it as the second feature. Why, do you ask?
I can remember seeing it for the first time on television, part of the Super Scary Saturday show on TBS. It was hosted by Al Lewis, in fact, none other than Grandpa Munster himself. My father was always talking about seeing The Green Slime at a local theater from when he was a kid. He really enjoyed it.
How old were you when you first caught the picture?
I was in my early teens. I think the theme song for the film is what has stuck with me all these years. Overall, I wasn't quite as enamored by the movie as my father was back in the day. I even kind of started doing a little pre-Mystery Science Theater 3000 while we watched it, which didn't go over that well. Hey! It's Rockford J.
Hey, Projectionist. Vic.
How's it going, Rockford?
Doing okay. About to call it a day and head up to the surface and catch the green slime.
How about you inform us of your search for Bobby Joe and the rest of the missing plague rats, intern Rockford J?
Still no sign of the dangerous little freaks.
That lure of projector cleaning fluid on level 15 didn't pan out?
Afraid not, Vic. There is something that's come to light, though.
What have you discovered, intern Rockford J?
I haven't found anything yet. It was Michelle from the food court on level 4. I just read a report from security that 2 pallets of Hansley's Raspberry Jungle Juice is missing, as well as a box of Vauban Vomit Absorbent.
Seems like an odd thing to go missing, to say the very least, Rockford.
I agree, man. There were no signs of forced entry into the storage rooms, though. Although, the surveillance video is missing.
What do you mean, missing?
As in, the surveillance video that should be there is not. The tapes themselves are gone, Projectionist.
This is making the hairs on the back of my neck stand up.
I agree, Vic. I have Barnes and Steele informing security about this situation before they leave for the day.
Projectionist, I assume the wards around the Haunted Drive-In are all good?
Don't be a bigger imbecile than you usually are, Victor. If anything outside of the drive-in had tampered with protection wards I put up, I assure you, if something had managed to get through, you would know it.
That was rather ominous. Vic, Projectionist, are you still planning on talking about Event Horizon on the new podcast?
Absolutely, Rockford. Have you seen it before?
Yes, I've seen it before. In fact, I've only seen it once. I can honestly say that Event Horizon is the last movie I saw that literally gave me nightmares, and I've never watched it since. I think for me and Event Horizon, it's going to be one and done.
Thanks as always, Rockford. I'll talk with you tomorrow.
Intern Rockford J, I assume you plan on purchasing a ticket to see the Green Slime, yes?
Of course, Projectionist.
Enjoy the green slime, Rockford.
Will do, Vic. Have a better one, Projectionist.
That was incredibly rude, Projectionist. Even for you. Why would you make Rockford pay for his own ticket to see the show? He's been working all day. Back when I was working at a local theater, you didn't even have to work that day to catch as many films as you wanted. They would even write passes for the other theater chain.
Bah! I have a bottom line to keep an eye on, dear boy. do I charge for the water that I freely provide from the water fountains in the vault? The electricity used by the vault itself? Why, the energy needs to power up the antenna for the vault and broadcast our radio program across the world alone.
Projectionist? I thought you said you had a small portal open on level 21, that you were siphoning off energy from the Hoover Dam. Hey! You almost hit me in the head with that mug!
How dare you talk to me like that? Was it not I that brought you back safely from that dark alternative timeline? Was it not I, at great personal risk, that constructed this new vault here at the Haunted Drive-In when the old vault fell? You have no inkling of what I do to protect you and others from the dark threats of the universe, boy.
I'm sorry, man. Just calm down, Projectionist. Take it easy.
Take it easy? Take it easy? I should take your head.
Look at the control panel, Projectionist. The recording light's on.
I should take your head. Count of those at tonight's showing of the Little Shop of Horrors and the Green Slime. I will record them here in my ledger.
Listeners, thank you for joining us on another episode of the Saturday Frights podcast. We have chosen to continue to discuss horror films with a science fiction theme for this second episode of Season 3, as the subject for this show is 1997's Event Horizon.
You mentioned on our last radio broadcast that you felt as if 1979's Alien was, for all intents and purposes, a haunted house picture set in space. That goes double for this picture, in my humble opinion.
You are quite right, Projectionist. I remember seeing this film at the local theater of my youth, when it was originally released. What about you, though? Did you show it at the Haunted Drive-In?
Now, when it was originally released, Victor, you will remember I had some issues with the citizens of Haddonfield at that time.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about bringing that up. Well, I can tell you that when Event Horizon was released in my neck of the woods on August 15th of 1997, the audience that was in attendance, including my best friends, were totally blown away by the dark and twisted story that director Paul W.S. Anderson, screenwriter Philip Eisner, as well as the cast and crew of the film delivered. At the time that Event Horizon was released, I was working full-time at a 5-star restaurant.
A 5-star establishment would hire the likes of you.
And self-esteem is now at an all-time low. As I was saying, Projectionist, at that point I was working full-time, opening and closing the restaurant 6 days a week, so it wasn't uncommon that I could be there for 18 hours a day. One of the benefits, though, besides being young and being able to handle such a work schedule, was I received a pretty long lunch break. I would frequently hit B. Dalton's and the toy store at the mall, which was basically just down the street. After grabbing some lunch at the food court, if the plan with my friends was to catch a movie after I got off work on the weekends, I would actually drop in on a matinee showing of whatever film we were going to catch, just to kind of check it out.
So you would watch a matinee before seeing it with your friends?
I guess I should have explained that better. Since I had so much free time before heading back to work, I would drop in at the theater and watch, like, 10 to 15 minutes of the film. If it looked like a stinker, I would of course let my friends know that we needed to change our plans for that night. For what it's worth, having worked at the movie theater for like 9 years, I could just head on in, grab a soda, and check it out. As silly as it might sound, being at the movies even for that short amount of time just kind of picked me up, especially when dealing with the stress of the restaurant. So anyway, if you've had the pleasure of seeing Event Horizon, you know that the scares start rather quickly. And, while as I've shared before, I was kind of the only person in my group of friends who really enjoyed horror films, I had a good feeling about the rest of Event Horizon, and I can tell you that I wasn't disappointed. And as I remember it, neither were my friends. Granted, the film benefited from not just Paul W.S. Anderson's direction, but that screenplay by Philip Eisner. Speaking of the script, I have read online that Eisner had unfortunately suffered a family tragedy. His mindset at the time, he felt that working would be the best way to overcome his grief. So in a meeting, as I understand it, with Paramount Pictures, he presented an idea for what would become Event Horizon that he described as The Shining set in outer space. Apparently, the studio liked the idea, but Philip found that working on the script itself proved problematic with his emotional state, experiencing a crippling case of writer's block.
Oh my! How did Philip Eisner overcome this obstacle, Victor?
With the help from a friend. In fact, it was his contact at the studio. He worked with Eisner on keeping on a writing schedule. And when the first draft was completed, to the writer's delight, the studio loved it. Although, it would appear that the original screenplay was a little different than what we would see in the film itself.
How so?
Well, for one thing, besides Sam Neill's character of Dr. Weir, being informed of the very unexpected return of the Event Horizon, in a meeting with a character called Admiral Hollis, we get the idea that Dr. Weir, while a good guy, might not be in the best mental state right off the bat. The really huge difference, though, is that the original premise, instead of the Event Horizon itself being altered from its trip, becoming haunted or evil for the lack of better words, the threat to the crew of the Lewis and Clark was an alien infestation, a tentacled one at that.
Perhaps that draft of the screenplay was intended to have an H.P. Lovecraft influence.
Possibly. I've read that Anderson was sent the script by Paramount after he had finished 1995's Mortal Kombat, which did very well for itself. The director liked the overall idea of a haunted house in space, but he felt that with the alien aspect, it might skew too close to, well, 1979's Alien. And while some of the production design for the interior of the Lewis and Clark would definitely be a tip of the hat to Ridley Scott's film, the director wanted to focus more on a supernatural horror. As I understand it, Philip Eisner and Anderson reworked the screenplay, with supposedly Andrew Kevin Walker of Seven and Sleepy Hollow fame doing an uncredited pass on the script. Here's a fun fact. Philip, over the last 23 years since the film was originally released, has admitted that perhaps he was subconsciously inspired by elements from the many years he played Warhammer 40K.
Warhammer 40, what's it?
A long-running and exceptional game universe that presents a very dark future for mankind, my friend. One that includes large gothic-looking space vessels, similar to the look of the Event Horizon starship in the film. I can also tell you that some fans of the 1997 film have jokingly asked the filmmakers if Event Horizon isn't in fact a prequel of sorts to the Warhammer 40K game.
It appeared to me to share many elements of the Hellraiser franchise.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. Online, I've read that Clive Barker was either asked to give his opinion on the screenplay, as Anderson has often said that Hellraiser was an inspiration on the film, as well as how the gravity drive looks when in operation on the Event Horizon. Or Clive Barker was actually invited to consult during the pre-production process. Personally, I feel that the truth lies more with the former than the latter. Either way, I have not found any definite proof. Speaking of the gothic look of the Event Horizon ship in the film, Projectionist, did you know that Paul W.S. Anderson based the ship's design on Notre Dame?
What?
Yeah, in an interview I found at The Ringer by Miles Surrey, published just last month, the director stated, quote, "Using an architectural CAM program, we basically built Notre Dame Cathedral in the computer. And then we pulled it apart and we used different elements of it to build the Event Horizon. So, the towers from Notre Dame became the engine thruster pods." End quote. I will be sure to include a link to that interview for this podcast post on the Pop Culture Retrorama site. It's a great read. The gothic touches to the Event Horizon aren't just confined to the exterior of the ship. The interior also boasts that design. For example, the medical bay on the cursed vessel has cathedral-like pillars, the displays resembling something like stained glass windows, which which is appropriate for an interstellar haunted house, right? To say nothing of the fact that the ship itself, when looking at it from above, has a heavy crucifix outline too. I suppose that due to the success of Mortal Kombat, which obviously had its own fair share of visual effects, Anderson and his team agreed to a rather tight deadline to deliver the film. I bring this up as it is one of the things the filmmakers themselves feel ended up hurting the film a little, with a rushed production. It went from being greenlit by Paramount to being in the theaters in 10 months. For what it's worth, while not a perfect film, I really do think that Event Horizon is a far better horror film than most people give it credit for.
Why did the studio feel the need to rush this to the theaters?
From what I've read online, it was because Paramount Studios originally had James Cameron's Titanic scheduled for August. But as a little more time was needed on that picture, and it was pushed back, they needed something to fill that slot. And they felt that Event Horizon would be an obvious hit. Now, I am sad to say that Event Horizon did not fare well at the box office. On a budget of $60 million, it managed to earn only $26 million. Although, at the very least, like many of John Carpenter's films, The Thing, Big Trouble in Little China, and In the Mouth of Madness, Event Horizon managed to find its intended audience on cable and home releases. So much so that in August of 2019, it was announced that Paramount and Amazon Studios were joining up to create a television series based on the film, with Your Next's director Adam Wingard set to act as executive producer, and possibly step in as a director for the series. And speaking of John Carpenter, the next film that Paul W.S. Anderson directed was 1998's Soldier, which starred Kurt Russell, who has of course appeared in a few of Carpenter's films over the years. Apparently, Anderson showed a cut of Event Horizon to the actor while they were working on Soldier, and Russell had some solid words of advice about Event Horizon. In a 2017 article written by Jacob Hall on slashfilm.com, from an excerpt from a Facebook Live Q&A event, Anderson stated, quote, "I met with John Goldwyn, who was the head of production at Paramount, like a year afterwards, and he said, 'You know, we really messed that movie up. We should have released it better. We could have released it better. It's a better movie than the marketing campaign we gave it. But I'm very happy with what happened with the movie. You know, it did reasonable business when it came out, but it wasn't like spectacular in any regard. But over time it grew. And actually, when it came out, I screened it for Kurt Russell, who I was about to make a movie with. And he said, 'Forget about what this movie's doing now. In 15 years' time, this is going to be the movie you're glad you made.' And he was right. Smart guy." End quote. Of course, I will include a link to that article on the Pop Culture Retrorama site as well. While the marketing campaign may not have been the best, I can recall seeing that wonderful poster for the film in the lobby of the local theater. The really beautiful and haunted-looking Event Horizon space vessel, with the front of the ship having that almost skull-like appearance. The poster bore the tagline, "Infinite Space, Infinite Terror."
A rather generic tagline, wouldn't you agree, dear listeners?
Well, I can tell you this. I love the poster so much that I made sure that when it was time to remove it from the lobby, that I was able to take it home. It hung up on my bedroom wall for quite some time. Now, before we begin to tackle the synopsis for Event Horizon, I think we should touch upon some of the fantastic casts that were assembled for the film. We've already mentioned Sam Neill, who plays Dr. William Weir. In 1997, he was probably best known as Dr. Alan Grant from Jurassic Park. You know, that global phenomenon of a movie that was released just 4 years earlier. For what it's worth, though, my first encounter with Sam Neill was 12 years earlier, in that very same movie theater, and in that very same auditorium, as Damien Thorne in 1981's The Final Conflict, the third film in the Omen series. Heading up the crew of the Lewis and Clark is Captain Miller, played by the esteemed Lawrence Fishburne. Peters, the medical technician, was played by Apollo 13's Kathleen Quinlan. Jolie Richardson, of Nip Tuck fame, played Lieutenant Stark, who handled communications and was XO on the ship. With dog soldiers, Sean Pertwee as Smitty, who's the rough-and-tumble pilot for the Lewis and Clark, and probably my favorite character. U-571's Jack Noseworthy played Ensign Justin, who acted as the ship's chief engineer. And Dragonheart's Jason Isaacs is DJ, the slightly unhinged MD. And last but not least is Richard T. Jones, probably best known for the TV series Judging Amy, who played Cooper, the chief rescue technician and the rescue ship's resident cut-up. As we mentioned last week when discussing Alien, Event Horizon is an ensemble film too. It works at the end of the day because we care about these characters. The crew members of the Lewis and Clark come up against something supernatural. The tension becomes ratcheted up because how are they going to escape this evil they've come across? They're in space. There's nowhere to escape to. I've heard Anderson say, by the way, that the cast really bonded during the filming. And I truly believe that shows up in the finished product, even if it's been heavily edited. More on that, though, during the synopsis. As always, friends, if you've not had the pleasure of watching Event Horizon for yourself yet, and don't want to be spoiled on the film, pause here and join us after you've checked out the movie. Projectionist, I believe you found something of interest for the listeners?
Do you even need to ask, Sage?
A haunted ship.
I'm getting some really strange readings in here.
A missing crew.
This place is a tomb.
DJ, where are you?
And infinite evil.
The ship has been beyond the boundaries of our universe. Who knows what it's brought back with it?
Vacate! I want off this ship.
You can't leave. She won't let you.
Event Horizon. Rated R.
Friends, as we mentioned on the Alien episode, with this, the third season of the Saturday Frights podcast, the goal is to try and shorten the synopsis, not to deliver an in-depth beat-by-beat of the film or television show itself.
Let me inspect my dictionary here, dear boy. Synopsis, a brief summary or general survey of something.
Exactly, Projectionist. During the synopsis, we will naturally point out the moments we enjoyed the best and still try to share some interesting information.
And you have already failed with the summary for Event Horizon.
I can remember like it was yesterday. The Retroist said, "Hey, you love horror movies? Why not start a podcast with a projectionist? You'll get along nicely."
What was that?
I said that as Event Horizon begins, we immediately get the sense of something ominous, as the familiar Paramount Studios logo is overtaken by a dark shadow, as the camera pans up to the stars, with the driving soundtrack by the late and great Michael Kamen. Actually, Kamen scored the film that Anderson passed up to direct Event Horizon, which was 2000's X-Men. As Event Horizon begins, thanks to some text, we learn that, in 2015, humanity has begun to colonize the stars, with an attempt to reach even further. The Event Horizon, an experimental deep space research vessel, is launched in 2040, with a crew of 18 to, quote, explore the boundaries of the solar system, end quote, which then totally and unexpectedly vanishes around Neptune. Now, it is 2047, and as we're about to find out, the ship has somehow reappeared above the eighth planet. I mentioned earlier that the scares in Event Horizon start rather quickly, as we are introduced to the character of Dr. Weir, who is aboard a space station above the Earth, has a disturbing nightmare of a screaming corpse aboard the lost ship, which he just happened to have a hand in designing. It is obvious in this introductory scene that Weir has experienced a personal tragedy. As we find out later, the loss of his wife, who is named Claire. It was his overwhelming devotion to the Event Horizon project that drove her to commit suicide. The reappearance of the Event Horizon is peculiar to say the least. To make matters worse, the vessel is caught in a decaying orbit around Neptune, as Dr. Weir, who is familiar with the ship the most, is picked up by the Lewis and Clark, which is a rescue vehicle, and heads out on a secret mission. Only Weir is privy to what their true mission is, and he is staying mum until they arrive. The stress of the G-forces in getting to Neptune means the trip requires the crew to be submerged in a stasis tank, sleeping through the voyage.
Not that it's a peaceful slumber for poor Dr. William Weir, eh?
No. As he awakens before any of the other crew members of the Lewis and Clark, Weir makes his way to the bridge to find his dead wife sitting naked in the pilot's chair. Perhaps dazed from his time in the stasis chamber, Dr. Weir doesn't question as to why or how she could be on the rescue ship. As he approaches her and turns the chair around, she suddenly appears at his side, and we see that her eyes are missing, as if they've been scooped out, and she commandingly says, "I'm waiting," before Weir awakes in an understandable panic in his stasis chamber. Just a nightmare, it would seem.
More like the first assault from the Event Horizon.
That is true, and it is most certainly not the last. Having arrived at their destination, it is time for Dr. Weir to reveal what their top secret operation is all about, which is to try and rescue the original crew members, or at the very least, salvage the Event Horizon. Which comes as a shock to the crew, as it has gone down in the history books as the worst space disaster ever recorded. Dr. Weir continues to blow the crew the loose in Clark's minds when he reveals that the Event Horizon was in fact sent out to test a gateway, an experimental gravity drive, one that creates an artificial black hole, in theory opening up two points in space-time, allowing near instantaneous travel to previously unreachable distances.
Something went wrong, however, during the Event Horizon's maiden voyage, and the testing of the gateway.
As this was a secret mission, Weir explains that the government covered it all up, concocting the story about the ship being destroyed. Then, the good doctor shares that a single transmission was sent when the Event Horizon reappeared. A distress beacon, with emphasis on distress, as he plays it for the crew of the Lewis and Clark. While at first, it just sounds like noise. When filtering out all the background noise, which sounds like screams of fear and anguish, there appears to be something in Latin, which DJ is able to translate. And it's not an uplifting message.
I think it sounds like Latin.
Can you translate it?
Play it again. What's that? You hear that? Sounds like liberate me something. I don't know. I can't make out the rest.
Liberate me.
Save me.
While that rather ominous translation sinks in, the klaxon alarms fill the Lewis and Clark, notifying they are approaching the Event Horizon. Anderson smartly uses the clouds of Neptune to mask the vessel from sight as the Lewis and Clark flies towards it, adding lightning from the planet's raging storms to heighten the feeling of unease, before the Event Horizon comes barreling out of the fog, almost smashing into the Lewis and Clark. It's not just a great jump scare, but it helps to sell the menace of what the space vessel has become. Plus, as the director himself has stated, it's meant to invoke the feeling of approaching a ghost ship on the seas, say like with the Mary Celeste. There are no signs of life aboard the Event Horizon. No replies from Stark's hails, and sensors indicate there isn't any gravity on the ship, and even the heat is currently non-functioning.
Nor is there any signs of outward damage to the Event Horizon herself, presenting a mystery of what became of the crew, yes?
Captain Miller decides to dock with the ship and send out a search party. After all, this is supposed to be a rescue and salvage operation. Perhaps sticking to horror tropes, Smitty picks airlock number 13 to dock with. Miller, Peters, and Justin board the vessel and get a closer look. Here's a fun fact I found out. Apparently, the spacesuits used in the film weighed 65 pounds. One of those reasons is it included an LED lighting system in the helmet. Plus, and perhaps more importantly, a filter blowing system to keep the actors from getting too hot, and also allowing the faceplate of the helmets to remain clear. The problem is that the actors couldn't sit down while wearing them. So, special poles were constructed to help keep the weight off the actors themselves. Basically, they would hang from them, which I'm sure must have been an odd sight. In fact, Philip Eisner, while visiting the set, during one of the scenes involving Fishburne wearing the suit, hanging from the pole between takes, has said that Lawrence Fishburne would point at him and jokingly cry out, "You, Eisner, you did this to me." Anyway, what is not so funny is what the trio find after boarding the Event Horizon. After splitting up, Miller checking out the medical bay, with Justin scoping out the engine room, leaving Peters to head to the bridge. Although, she doesn't see it when she first enters, a lightning flash illuminates some of the port windows, and they are covered in gore and viscera, including human skulls. While Peters is collecting the ship's log, she is startled by a frozen corpse that bumps into her, one that looks suspiciously like the one that Weir had a nightmare about in the beginning of the film, eyeless and mouth opened wide in an eternal scream.
As if that nightmare at the beginning was the Event Horizon calling to its creator.
I think that is exactly what it was supposed to mean. Justin enters the engine room where the ship's gateway, the gravity core, is kept. The design of the gravity core chamber features large spikes throughout, which obviously gives off a very dangerous vibe to the room itself. Coolant liquid around the base of the core is floating around the chamber. And over the comms, Weir, rather pleased with himself, explains that the core is the heart of the ship.
And the Event Horizon contains a black heart at that.
Indeed, my friend. The core spins up on its own, lights flashing brightly for a moment as the core becomes a glassy black portal. Understandably curious, Justin touches it and finds himself yanked through by something. At the same time, the gravity drive momentarily springs into life, which results in a shockwave that passes through the entire vessel, including the Lewis and Clark, damaging it badly, causing a breach in the hull, which forces Weir, Stark, Smitty, and DJ to abandon the ship for the safety of the Event Horizon. By the way, when Justin was pulled through and Stark lost communications with her fellow crew member, Cooper was sent to find out what happened to the engineer. He arrives just in time to witness Justin reemerge from the gateway, unconscious. Cooper rushes him to the medical bay, and he is physically fine, but in a coma. Cooper and Smitty are dispatched to begin working on sealing the breach on the Lewis and Clark, with DJ attending to Justin, and Peters attempting to clear up the mission logs she discovered. Stark delivers some more bad news to Miller. The CO2 scrubbers on the Event Horizon are shot, and the research vessel can only provide 20 hours of oxygen. So the clock is ticking. Meanwhile, Peters, who is in the medical bay and keeping an eye on Justin, hears scratching coming from a sealed medical tent. Earlier in the film, we learned that the medical technician had to leave her ill son with her ex-husband while she was away on the mission. The young boy appears to not be able to walk, although it appears the boy is suffering from some kind of disease, at least judging by the home videos she is watching, which is why Peters is so shocked to find him in the medical bay under that tent, with absolutely horrifying lesions covering his legs, all the while calling out to her in distress. As if that wasn't the worst thing the mother could witness, for some unknown reason, a power drain occurs on the Event Horizon, which Weir realizes is being caused by the gravity drive. Miller and the doctor race to the engine room to investigate, with Weir having to crawl into the maintenance areas underneath the engineering room in an attempt to fix what he feels is a short in the power system.
If only that is what it truly was, dear listeners. A simple malfunction in the system.
While Weir is attempting to fix the situation, he is visited once again by his dead wife. He's not the only one, though, to see something strange, as Captain Miller is confronted in the engine room by a burning figure who rises up out of the coolant liquid. As we will later learn, this is a crew member from a previous mission that Miller was forced to abandon. Korik was his name, and the captain watched him burn to death.
The Event Horizon is tapping into the guilts and fears of its new passengers.
That is absolutely what is going on. And one of the things I love most is that Miller is quick to embrace that notion. Fishburne really conveys how spooked he is by the situation. He isn't hysterical or anything like that. He just knows that something is very wrong with this ship. Obviously, Peter shares her own vision, but Dr. Weir claims he hasn't experienced anything bizarre. In fact, he's rather insultingly dismissive of what Miller and Peters share. While DJ and Smitty admit they've seen nothing strange, the pilot for the Lewis and Clark has already made up his mind that the Event Horizon is not a normal ship, and they need to get away from it quickly as possible. The situation becomes explosive, though, when Weir dismisses the visions as mere hallucinations. Even when Miller explains he felt the heat coming off Korik. Perhaps inadvertently pushing his buttons, Smitty lashes out at Weir, with DJ grabbing him in a chokehold and suddenly brandishing a scalpel, holding it against his friend's throat, urging him to calm down, all the while whispering the Event Horizon is just a ship. It's just a machine.
I enjoyed this scene in particular, Sage, as it reveals that DJ, who appears to be the picture of calmness in all situations, is in fact terrified at what is occurring aboard the Event Horizon.
I think you're right about that, Projectionist. Thankfully, Smitty doesn't appear to hold a grudge against DJ, although I'm sure he's secretly grateful to be sent off to keep working on repairs by his captain. It bears pointing out that while it would appear that Dr. Weir is just trying to be rational, he is a scientist after all, it borders on denial, especially as we know he has seen visions of his wife. While the repairs continue on the Lewis and Clark with Miller's help, the evil of the Event Horizon continues to manifest itself. First, when another power drain occurs, with Peters, Stark, DJ, and Weir experiencing something trying to punch its way through the sealed bulkhead doors of the bridge. Weir actually attempts to open the door, but Stark is quick to act and subdues the Doctor, who acts like he's almost in a trance. There is worse news, though. Justin has woken up on his own, and whatever he has experienced, or perhaps he's possibly possessed by the ship itself, he has locked himself in an airlock and engaged the outer door without a spacesuit. He's going to kill himself rather than risk being pulled back into wherever that gateway took him. Miller is able to rescue him outside of the Event Horizon, but not before massive damage is done to the young man, resulting in the crew placing him in stasis. Peters is able to clear up the final log from the crew of the Event Horizon, at the same time that DJ realizes he made a mistake in the translation of the message earlier. It wasn't save me. It was save yourself from hell. While the majority of the recovered logs is just the crew having a bit of fun before the gravity drive is engaged, the last images are a nightmarish collection of agony and depravity. The crew members are attacking each other, engaging in self-mutilation, and much, much worse. Miller shuts it down after a few seconds, but it goes on long enough to see that the Event Horizon's captain has torn out his own eyes and seems to be offering them up to whomever is holding the camera. Miller wisely decides that it is not only time to leave the Event Horizon, but they are also going to destroy the cursed vessel. This is something that Dr. Weir rails against, but Miller has made his mind up. Smitty and Peters are to reclaim what functioning CO2 scrubbers remain and bring them aboard the Lewis and Clark. Stark is to download the files from the Event Horizon, and Weir, well, he calmly explains to Miller that he isn't going anywhere as he's home before vanishing into the darkness. I mentioned the film underwent a heavy editing process earlier, and the majority of the scenes involve the level of gore in this log video, as well as during that scene where Peters sees her son in the medical bay. In the original cut of the film, maggots began to emerge from his sores.
Ugh.
The test audiences were understandably disgusted, and even Anderson has said that it was a good thing they took that particular scene out of the film. Although, I've read, he does believe that adding in about 10 minutes of the original film, which would include a little more gore, would strengthen the film overall.
Captain Miller has the right idea of leaving as quickly as possible, but it appears that the Event Horizon is quite through playing nicely.
Yeah, while Smitty is understandably ready to get off the ship, leaving Peters behind after collecting those CO2 scrubbers, Peters sees the gateway. The gravity drives spin to life briefly and finds herself chasing her son through the passageways of the engineering room, the vision leading her to her death. As she steps into the open shaft above the gravity drive, she plummets down, breaking her legs painfully in the process before hitting a metal walkway in front of the drive, living just long enough to see the image of her son far up above, cruelly smiling down at her. It is Dr. Weir who enters the engineering room moments later, aghast at the broken form of Peters before him. So perhaps the Event Horizon hasn't taken full control of him yet. Although, that is a brief respite, as he is visited by his wife once again. More so, the Doctor appears to be back in his apartment on the space station, and agonizingly has to watch as his wife takes her own life in a bathtub. This vision breaks Dr. Weir, and when the eyeless form of Claire appears beside him, once more, she embraces him, explaining that he will never be alone again. We see that in the engineering room, though, Dr. Weir is screaming and clawing his own eyes out. Now, fully possessed by the ship, Weir sets out to make sure Miller and the others will not be able to leave. Earlier in the film, we learned there were explosives set up in the long corridors that connect the fore and aft of the vessel. In an emergency, the crew could use the fore as a lifeboat, as it contains stasis chambers, the explosion separating it from the rest of the ship. After Smitty reports Dr. Weir showing up on the Lewis and Clark in the airlock, Captain Miller, to his horror, realizes that one of the explosives is missing. Smitty finds that Weir has planted it on the Lewis and Clark, with 6 seconds left on its countdown. Just enough time to close his eyes and accept his fate, as the rescue vessel explodes. Cooper, who was finishing up repairs to the ship, is sent hurtling out into space. Miller contacts DJ in the medical bay, informing him of the loss of the Lewis and Clark, as well as Smitty and presumably Cooper. He says, in no uncertain terms, that if he sees Weir, he is to take him out. Something the DJ says will not be a problem as he picks up a surgical saw and prepares to hunt down the doctor. Unfortunately, Dr. Weir is already in the medical bay, his eyes torn from their sockets, with deep and bloody scratches on his face. Possessed with superhuman strength now, he picks up the MD and begins to hurl him around the room. Miller races for the medical bay, hearing DJ's cries of pain, only to arrive and find that Weir has performed a vivisection on DJ, leaving him hanging from the ceiling of the room with his insides neatly lined up in order on a table beneath the poor man.
Dr. Weir is taking out anyone who could oppose the Event Horizon's will, it would seem.
You're correct, projectionist. Miller races to the bridge and finds Stark unconscious. They're not alone, however. Weir is sitting in the captain's chair, having taken time to pull down and sew the flesh from his forehead over his missing eyes. He's also pointing one of the repair guns from the Lewis and Clark at Captain Miller. These devices are able to fire off a long and very sharp bolt. There's no doubt now that something supernatural has taken over Dr. Weir, as there is obviously no way he could be tracking Miller with no eyes, right? Gloating that the Event Horizon has a new crew now, he begins a 10-minute timer to fully open the gateway, ripping open a portal to wherever that nightmarish dimension is located.
Very good time for Cooper to make his appearance against the outside of the bridge window.
Totally, projectionist. Cooper, you see, used the air in his suit as a makeshift rocket pack after he'd been blown off the Lewis and Clark. Weir fires off a bolt towards Cooper, rupturing the bridge window. While Miller and Stark are able to retreat further into the ship, Dr. Weir is sucked out into space through the damaged window. The emergency systems seal the bridge before the entire ship decompresses, and Cooper thankfully is able to make it into an airlock. The trio decide it's time to blow the rest of the explosive charges and take their chances in the stasis chambers of the forward section. While Cooper and Stark are getting everything prepared, Captain Miller arms the explosive devices in the central corridor, locating the remote detonator. Before he can join his comrades, however, he is assaulted by the burning Korik once again, driven backwards into the engine room. Korik hasn't given up the chase, however, and begins to assault Miller, before transforming into a scarred and quite naked Dr. Weir. When I say scarred, it's like someone took a scalpel to his entire body. Miller tries to attack Weir, who has managed to regrow his eyes after the ship brought him back. But the truth is, he's totally outmatched. Grabbing Miller, Weir forces a vision into the captain's mind of what awaits his crew in whatever dimension the ship managed to travel to 7 years earlier. Horrible images of his crew strapped to the gravity core with barbed wire, or impaled on those spikes surrounding the room, very much still alive and screaming in agony. Miller pleads with Weir to take him, but to leave Cooper and Stark. With much malice, Weir explains to Miller that the ship has other plans for all of them.
Perhaps if Dr. William Weir was not so busy gloating, he would have noticed that Captain Miller has managed to retrieve the remote detonator.
Exactly. Slamming that detonation switch, the corridor explodes as Weir screams in rage at being denied both Cooper and Stark. And Justin as well, I suppose. As the forward section is pushed away from the aft section of the Event Horizon. Although, it bears pointing out that Miller may have saved what is left of his crew. The gravity drive opens and sucks Miller, Weir, and the rest of the Event Horizon into the open gateway. Miller, for his bravery, is probably going to spend eternity being tortured by whatever awaits in that alternate dimension. I'm sure that this is what Cooper and Stark are thinking as they watch the remains of the Event Horizon disappear, and the gateway closes. With no other option, the two survivors enter into stasis and await rescue, which occurs 72 days later, when a rescue ship docks with them. The lead of the team of rescuer awakens Stark first, who is justifiably still shaken. As for her, the nightmarish events were just hours ago. Her first thoughts are to ask about the status of Cooper and Justin. The rescue team are all wearing spacesuits, the lead rescuer informing her they are fine and safe, before flipping up the visor on his helmet to reveal it's Dr. Weir, who with a smirk remarks, "They're with us."
It turns out to be just a nightmare, though, as Stark wakes on the floor outside her stasis pod, screaming as Cooper leans beside her, telling her it is all right, that they are safe.
But Stark continues to scream as the lead rescuer, who is obviously not Weir, calls for one of his teams to bring a sedative. And as Event Horizon ends, we see the bulkhead doors close on their own. Which is either just a stylish way to end the film, or we can take it as part of the evil of the Event Horizon is still present.
Oh, that the physical and mental anguish that Stark has gone through has pushed the poor woman to the point of losing her grip on sanity.
Yeah, I guess Anderson wisely leaves it to the individual viewer to decide what the ending means. Now, before we wrap up this episode on 1997's Event Horizon, we should mention that there has been talk, for a while now, about a director's cut of the film. As I understand it, they did locate the original negatives. Although, the bad news is, they had been moved to a salt mine and were damaged beyond repair. There is a little hope, however. Perhaps, like with Nightbreed, the director's cut, the answer might lie on a VHS tape. One that supposedly producer Lloyd Levin has in his possession. A VHS tape containing the work print of Event Horizon. Although Levin lives in Spain now. Scream Factory announced a collector's edition Blu-ray for Event Horizon that is to be released in January of 2021, with a press release on its Facebook page stating, quote, "As for any much inquired about additional footage, in addition to what's been presented on prior releases, we are looking into it as best we can. We welcome any leads you may have alongside our efforts," end quote. So, let's cross our fingers that something can be located. And friends, I think that wraps up our episode on Event Horizon. As always, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to listen to the show. And we hope you're enjoying the third season so far. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. My co-host, The Projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. He manages to share interesting trivia on films on a daily basis, or sometimes just vintage movie posters and behind-the-scenes photographs of some of your favorite films. As always, I want to thank Rockford J for putting up with the abuse of The Projectionist on a nearly daily basis. I couldn't keep a lid on the vault without his hard work. In addition, he shares his own love of horror films every day on the Saturday Frights Facebook page. As for myself, you can still find me posting on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee page, and of course the Pop Culture Retrorama site too. Saturday Frights has an Instagram account, by the way, if you want to check it out. You can find it. It's simply Saturday_Frights. If you would like to contact me with suggestions for future episodes, you can reach me at vicsagepopculture@gmail.com. For all things pop culture and retro-related, feel free to visit us at the Pop Culture Retrorama site. Generally, we have something of interest to share a couple of times a day. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself. not just for originally hosting the podcast, but for allowing us for nearly 10 years to share our love of all things retro. If you like the show, consider subscribing and giving us a rating over on iTunes. Our past catalog of episodes are slowly coming back online, but you can still listen to the entire collection over on the Internet Archive. We are also available on Google Podcasts and Spotify and Stitcher. As we end the show, why not listen to a clip from the film we will be discussing next week?
This is all that's left of her, this and dust. Look, here's Chuck. Where are the kids? It's Saturday morning. Where are the kids?
This has been a Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. Goodbye, and thanks for listening. The Saturday Frights podcast is not affiliated with or authorized by any of the businesses or individuals that have been mentioned in the show. All music and sound clips are the property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Audio clips are included for the purpose of review, criticism, and commentary only, and are not intended to infringe.
What happened to your eyes?
Where am I going? We won't need eyes to see.